Today is Wednesday, October 7th.
This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, with COVID now within the White House, tonight's vice presidential debate between Mike Pence and Kamala Harris takes on bigger significance than previous years.
Like all things this year, coronavirus has upended all political events and really shook up what the conventional wisdom is about how these races are run.
Three men have been arrested in Belgium in connection to Rwanda's 1994 genocide. Also ahead, a guitar rock legend is being mourned across the world. It's all on today's International Edition. With Election Day less than a month away, many Americans have voted early or voted by mail, and many more are expected to do so between now and November 3rd. Former Vice President and Democratic candidate Joe Biden has been campaigning in the swing state of Florida, while President Donald Trump, who is recovering from COVID-19, has vowed to be back on the campaign trail soon. VOA's Elizabeth Lee has more.
President Donald Trump is back in the White House recovering from COVID-19, saying on social media he is looking forward to a scheduled October 15th debate with Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden in Miami. In a separate recorded video posted on Twitter, Trump had the following message about the illness that put him in the hospital.
Don't let it dominate. Don't let it take over your lives. Don't let that happen. We have the greatest country in the world. We're going back. We're going back to work. We're going to be out front. As your leader, I had to do that. I knew there's danger to it, but I had to do it. I stood out front. I led.
But Trump's handling of his illness and approach to the pandemic is being criticized by Joe Biden, who spoke during an NBC News town hall Monday night.
These masks, they matter. It matters. It saves lives. It prevents the spread of the disease. Social distancing. Instead of talking about what the only thing I heard was one of the tweets saying that, you know, don't be so concerned about all this, essentially. There's a lot to be concerned about. 210,000 people have died.
Biden has been campaigning in the battleground state of Florida, a critical state in the presidential contest.
As you all know, and quite frankly, if we win Florida, you've won.
While Biden has been leading Trump in national polls, a new poll this week shows Trump is tied with Biden in Florida, a state Trump won in 2016. Voters 65 years and older are a key demographic in the U.S. because they are the most committed, says political analyst Rayfield Sonnenschein.
What seems to be happening under the surface is that Biden's small lead among older voters, an absolute bedrock for Republicans, is increasing.
Wednesday's vice presidential debate in Salt Lake City is the next major event on the campaign agenda. It is now even more relevant following Trump's illness.
It reminds everybody that there's a 74-year-old running against a 77-year-old for president, and two considerably younger people, one the vice president, the other running for vice president, who could easily be the next candidates on the ticket.
The debate styles of Vice President Mike Pence and vice presidential candidate Kamala Harris are likely to be different. Harris is a former prosecutor, Pence a former governor and radio talk show host. As head of the White House Coronavirus Task Force, Pence will likely be defending the administration's response to COVID-19. The outcome of the presidential race, says political analysts, will ultimately be a referendum on President Trump's handling of the coronavirus pandemic. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Vice President Mike Pence and Democratic vice presidential candidate Senator Kamala Harris will be face to face at the University of Utah tonight in their one and only debate. It will be yet another in a long line of political events that look a lot different due to the coronavirus pandemic. Joining us now is VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. Catherine, in a normal presidential election, the vice presidential debate really is pretty much a secondary event, but this is no ordinary election season.
That's right. In all honesty, a vice presidential debate is really not going to be making the decision for any American voter. They are going to be looking at the top of the presidential ticket. They'll be making their decision based on Donald Trump or Joe Biden. But it's a little bit different this year. Like all things this year, coronavirus has upended all political events. and really shook up what the conventional wisdom is about how these races are run and what candidates really should be doing. So obviously, when Pence comes out there, he is going to be defending the administration's track record on the coronavirus and his own role on the White House coronavirus task force. Expect Senator Kamala Harris to really go hard on him on that issue. But of course, she also has to be careful because the White House now has the world's most famous coronavirus patient, and she needs to remember to be tactful, she needs to be compassionate, and recognize that the first family has now been directly impacted by this pandemic, while pointing out the larger decision-making processes that caused some errors in the way this country, she says, has responded to the virus.
So, Catherine, now that the president has contracted the virus, along with a number of other White House officials who Vice President Mike Pence may have been in contact with, what sorts of precautions are debate organizers taking to make sure that the moderator, anyone sitting in the audience, and of course, Senator Kamala Harris, to ensure their safety?
That's right. So we know that the Biden campaign has asked for some accommodations, some changes to the way the debate stage is set up. So while President Donald Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden had about 7 feet of distance between them during that first presidential debate, now Kamala Harris and Mike Pence will have about 13 feet of distance between them. And they're negotiating through these plexiglass shields that will cover both the debate moderator and Senator Harris. What's still up for debate and negotiation is whether Vice President Mike Pence will have that plexiglass shield. He's saying that he doesn't need it at this point, but the Biden campaign is pushing back and saying that that would make them feel more comfortable to protect Senator Harris.
Obviously, the pandemic will be a topic of discussion in this debate. What other topics will they likely be debating as well?
Well, I think that we can expect coronavirus to really dominate the discussion Wednesday night. There are obviously other huge political issues that are ongoing in the United States right now, namely the Supreme Court nomination that's going to be coming up and starting just this next week, and really brings in both Vice President Mike Pence, who is involved in Senate business, and of course Senator Kamala Harris, who sits on the Senate Judiciary Committee, which will have that key vote advancing the nomination of Judge Amy Coney Barrett, President Trump's nominee, to fill the gap left by the death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. That's obviously going to be a huge political battle in the United States and something that they're going to want to talk about Wednesday night. I would also look for Senator Harris to bring up the wildfires that are ongoing in her state of California, and for her to kind of use that as a way to discuss environmental concerns that are important to many Democratic voters and that she'll really want to nail down Vice President Mike Pence on. That could definitely be a topic of discussion as well.
And so, Catherine, there are two more scheduled debates between President Trump and Joe Biden. What is the likelihood that this is actually the last in-person debate of the campaign? Do you think that the next two between the president and Biden will be virtual? What is the status of that?
That's really one of the big questions heading into the vice presidential debate Wednesday night, is whether or not this will be the very last time we see candidates in person debating each other. Because, of course, the country is still watching to see how President Trump recovers from the coronavirus and whether it'll even really be feasible for him to be in the same room as former Vice President Joe Biden, debating each other, how they would even work out the logistics of keeping them apart and making sure that nobody is infected. That's really up in the air right now. And of course, the first presidential debate didn't really receive great marks the first time around. There may not be the appetite to have everybody gather for a second and then a third time, particularly when the president is still recovering from the virus. So look for that question to really dominate discussion in the next few days and into next week while they're trying to sort out how to do all of this in a really new political environment.
VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson, thanks so much. Political analysts say regardless of who wins the U.S. election, a new regional alliance could emerge in the Middle East following Israel's peace deals with the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain, with perhaps more to follow. Dale Gavlak reports from Amman.
Middle East analysts anticipate the U.S. decreasing its military presence in the region while backing a proxy Israeli-Arab alliance to confront growing threats posed by Iran and Turkey. Jordanian analyst Osama El-Sharif says if President Trump wins a second term, we could possibly expect to see a new normal in the Middle East, where Israel would emerge as the backbone of a new regional alliance. Writing in the Jordan Times newspaper, he says that such an alliance could tackle threats posed by Iran and Turkey. Gulf countries in particular see both countries as expanding their influence in the Arab region and as posing an existential threat. This policy would also witness the disengagement by Israel's new allies from what used to be the central Arab cause, the Palestinian question, he writes. Al-Sharif says that a Biden presidency would likely reset the course of Washington's policy to resolving the Arab-Israeli conflict by resuming aid to the Palestinian Authority and reopen a U.S. consulate to deal with the Palestinians in East Jerusalem. But he says the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem would stay and there would be minimum engagement on a two-state solution to the crisis. The Biden campaign has hinted that the U.S. could return to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action nuclear deal of 2015 if Iran recommits, he says. Arab Rantawi of the El Quds Center for Political Studies in Amman sees a carrot-and-stick approach to Iran should President Trump be reelected.
I don't think there will be a need for a new strategic alliance between the Gulf and Israel to confront Iran. The inclusion of Iran, the integration of Iran in the international community and the world markets will be the approach. This process may change the policies of the Iranian regime more than sanctions. A few Arab countries are very worried to see the Democrats in office, especially Egypt, Bahrain, Emirates, and Saudi Arabia, because of human rights issues, their military adventure in the region, the humanitarian disaster in Yemen.
Salah Nasrawi, writing in Egypt's Al Ahram newspaper, expressed concern that whoever occupies the White House needs to counter the rising presence of Russia and China, which are contesting U.S. power in the Middle East through a combination of political and economic influence. An active role taken by the U.S. on addressing terrorism threats and finding ways to end conflicts in Iraq, Libya, Syria, and Yemen could jolt the Middle East out of its current geopolitical stasis, he says. Dale Geflek for VOA News, Amman.
Political chaos. On Tuesday, opposition groups in Kyrgyzstan said they'd seized control in the strategically important Central Asian country. They claim to have taken control of government buildings in the capital during protests over a recent parliamentary election. Reuters reporter Adam Reed has the story.
Kyrgyzstan is facing massive civil unrest, political upheaval, and its president says he's being threatened by an attempted coup. Rapid developments in the country that borders China and also hosts a Russian military base. Opposition leaders claim to have seized power there and stormed government buildings. They also say they freed a former president from prison on corruption charges. The protests were sparked by a parliamentary election the opposition wants annulled. In the capital, at least one person was killed and 590 wounded in unrest overnight, according to the government. This was President Sooronbay Jeenbekov on Tuesday.
They didn't obey law enforcement agencies, beat paramedics, and damaged buildings. I ordered the law enforcement agencies not to open fire, so there was no blood spilt and not a single citizen was injured. So far, they have done everything so as not to exacerbate the situation.
Kyrgyzstan is strategically located and has long been a platform for competition between Russia, China, and the United States. The trouble first started on Monday when police used tear gas and water cannons to disperse thousands of people demonstrating against the parliamentary results from weekend elections. Two establishment parties who advocate for close links to Moscow appear to have taken the most seats, but Western observers say the election had been marred by vote buying. The opposition says it has freed former president Almazbek Atambayev from jail and was already discussing the lineup of a provisional government. However, Jeenbekov showed no immediate signs of relinquishing power, and it remains unclear what role Atambayev might have.
Adam Reed reporting.
Federal prosecutors in Belgium announced Tuesday the arrest of three people of Rwandan origin on international law violations related to the 1994 genocide when Rwanda's Hutu ethnic majority killed about 800,000 minority Tutsis and Hutu moderates in 100 days. The arrests came as survivors have been demanding international justice in Belgium, the former colonial power in Burundi and Congo, as well as Rwanda, seeks to do more to come to terms with its past. Joining us now from Paris is reporter Catherine Field. Catherine, thanks for being with us. Did prosecutors say who these men are or what specifically they're accused of?
The prosecutor's office did not identify the suspects or give exact details of crimes they're accused of committing. What they have said is that the three are Rwandan and were living in Belgium. Two were arrested in the capital, Brussels, the third in the southern province of Hainaut. They were taken into custody last week. On Monday of this week, a pre-trial court hearing confirmed their arrest. And it was only late on Tuesday that federal prosecutors released information confirming the investigation. And even then, saying only that the three men faced charges of serious violations of international humanitarian law committed during the Rwanda genocide. One of the men, though, has since been released on condition he wear an electronic ankle bracelet.
Will they face extradition to Rwanda or, given the international arrest warrants, more likely face the International Criminal Court?
We know there was considerable cooperation between Belgian and Rwandan justice departments. Belgian prosecutors and investigators made several trips to Rwanda to interview witnesses. However, it isn't yet clear whether the three will be tried in Belgium or will be sent to Rwanda to face justice. You have to remember there have been a number of high-profile trials in Belgium of Rwandans accused of crimes committed during the genocide. Just last year, a Belgian court convicted a former Rwandan agricultural scientist for war crimes and sentenced him to 25 years in prison.
And Catherine, this, along with the recent arrest of Felicien Kabuga in Paris, must give survivors some sense of relief that they may actually see justice in their lifetimes, even if the wheels of justice move slowly. And did these arrests have any connection to Kabuga's, or is this a completely separate investigation?
Confirmation of these arrests comes just a week after a French court approved the extradition to a UN war crimes court of the alleged financier of the Rwandan genocide, Felicien Kabuga. We understand these arrests are not linked to that case. However, survivors are, of course, relieved that even after such a long period of time, these crimes are being investigated and those accused will face justice. But the question remains for them, why did it take so long, given that so many of these accused appeared on international wanted lists that were distributed to countries where it was known these fugitives had taken refuge?
Paris-based reporter Catherine Field, thanks so much. The U.S. has for years tried with mixed results to persuade its Asian allies to push back more strongly and collectively on China. But recently, the U.S. may be having some success at shoring up opposition to Beijing, and it's using a group known as the Quad to do it. VOA's Bill Gallo reports from Seoul.
Perhaps it's no big surprise that the U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo slammed China during his one-day visit to Japan on Tuesday. But more important was the setting, the latest meeting of a regional group of Asian countries known as the Quad. Composed of the U.S., India, Australia, and Japan, the Quad isn't quite an alliance. It's more of a series of defense talks. But in recent months, the Trump administration has revitalized the Quad as part of its efforts to more forcefully counter China. In his comments Tuesday, Pompeo took direct aim at the Chinese Communist Party, or CCP.
As partners in this Quad, it is more critical now than ever that we collaborate to protect our people and partners from the CCP's exploitation, corruption, and coercion.
Even by the standards of the Trump administration, that's unusually blunt language. And it's much bolder than the language other Quad members use to describe the group. Japan, Australia, and India all have crucial economic ties with China and frequently downplay the notion the Quad is meant to contain Beijing. Instead, they focus on its positive aspects, such as protecting the rules-based global order. But their role in the Quad has begun to change amid the coronavirus pandemic, which originated in China. Many of China's neighbors say it wasn't forthcoming enough about the virus. They're also concerned about China's increasing aggressiveness. For instance, on China's border with India, recent clashes killed at least 20 Indian soldiers. That's prompting soul searching in India, which has famously refused to choose sides between major powers, says New Delhi-based analyst Jagannath Panda.
India followed a non-aligned foreign policy, and India never wanted that Quad should emerge as a military maritime-centric initiative. But the way the problems with China has emerged on the boundary issues, definitely India is changing its game plan.
Australia, too, is embroiled in a major dispute with China. After it called for an independent investigation into the origins of the coronavirus, China hit back with economic measures. There have also been allegations of increased Chinese domestic interference in Australia, says analyst Andrew O'Neill.
From Australia's perspective, I think there's more appetite among policymakers in Australia to push back against China, partly because, largely I should say, I think because of the perception that the Chinese have become more aggressive in targeting Australia through espionage.
But although U.S. officials say they want to expand the scope and membership of the Quad, analysts don't expect a binding NATO-like military alliance anytime soon. That's because the complex web of competing economic interests and rivalries in Asia makes it difficult for many to choose between the U.S. and China. Even some U.S. allies say the choice doesn't need to be made at all. Asked earlier this month about the idea of joining an expanded Quad, South Korea's foreign minister said she doesn't think it's a good idea. And keep in mind, that's a statement coming from a country that hosts nearly 30,000 U.S. troops. It's a sign that while China's neighbors are getting more frustrated, for now, there may be a limit to how far they'll push back. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
You're listening to International Edition. We'll be right back.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists have proposed that early Mars was warm with vast amounts of liquid water flowing across its surface. A trio of scientists released a new study in the journal Nature Geoscience that disputes this popular theory. Instead, they propose the red planet was covered with ice sheets and that its valleys, thought to have been formed from free-flowing liquid water, were carved by water melting beneath them. The authors examined more than 10,000 valleys on Mars to determine processes used to shape them. Noticing the similarities of the Martian valleys with channels of subglacial meltwater on islands of the Canadian Arctic archipelago, they performed a comparative analysis. The researchers suggest their theory explains how valleys could have formed on a planet further from a weaker sun than Earth 3.8 billion years ago. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. Shackling patients with mental health conditions is sadly common practice in Africa, with some children as young as 10 being chained and locked in small spaces by their families, according to a new report by Human Rights Watch. The tragic move stems from widespread stigma about mental health and a lack of mental health services in many countries. VOA's Anita Powell spoke to activists and a victim of the practice and brings us this report from Johannesburg.
For nearly a year, Benjamin Bilal was chained to a rock. This was no Greek myth. This, for him and for hundreds of thousands of people around the world, many of them in Africa, was real life.
2 years back, I was taken to a faith healing center by my grandmother and my mother. There I was shackled. I was chained to a log where I stayed for about 11 months. There was no food. They gave us food at will. When they feel like giving you food, they give you food. And there we had no freedom moving around. You want to move around, you move around with chains.
What did he do to get this treatment? According to doctors at Liberia's only mental health facility, where he was finally taken after 11 months of being shackled, he suffered from depression. The World Health Organization estimates that as many as 1 in 5 Liberians suffer a mild to moderate mental disorder. In 2016, according to WHO data, the West African country had only 1 registered psychiatrist. Additionally, poverty and lack of awareness usually put mental health low on the list of priorities for many struggling families. Although this is a prevalent practice in Africa, this is a global problem, says Kriti Sharma, a Human Rights Watch researcher on disability rights. She authored this year's report on this degrading practice and shared some of her experiences. We warn you, they are hard to hear.
Shackled people live in extremely unsanitary and degrading conditions. Many are forced to eat, sleep, urinate, defecate in a very small space, sometimes no larger than 1 to 2 meter radius. Simply put, dignity is being denied. One man in Kenya told me, "I've been chained for 5 years. The chain is so heavy, it makes me sad." He stays in a room with seven men. He's not allowed to wear clothes. He only wears an underwear, and he has to go to the toilet in a bucket. He told me, "It's not how a human being is supposed to be. A human being should be free."
Sharma said this happens because many governments do not provide adequate support and services for people with mental health issues. Michael Njenga, Kenya-based chairman of the Pan-African Network for People with Psychosocial Disabilities, says he has two recommendations for governments.
We need absolute prohibition in terms of shackling. I think that for me is very, very important, that we need to have the enabling legal frameworks to address all the challenges. But we need to go beyond legal frameworks and look at what other systematic things do we need to address. And I think for me, most importantly, is that looking at the intersection between availability of mental health services within the community, it is important to ensure that we develop a wide range of community-based mental health services that respond to the needs of persons with psychosocial disabilities.
And, says Sharma, the report's author, the global pandemic has made the problem even more dire.
People go in and out of chains depending on the support that's available in the community. I've personally documented a case who was shackled for 8 years in a shed. He was freed. He went back to the community because he had access to support. He had a job. He, you know, did the local call to prayer in his mosque. And then 4 years later, when COVID-19 hit, he was shackled once again by his family because there was a disruption in government services.
Benjamin Bilal's story, however, has a better ending. After his older brother fished him out of the Faith Healing Center and took him to a mental health facility in Monrovia, he was able to complete his education. He's now a school teacher and a mental health activist, working with governments to make sure what happened to him never happens to anyone else. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Three scientists who unraveled some of the deep mysteries of black holes, the awe-inspiring pockets of the universe where space and time cease to exist, have won the 2020 Nobel Prize in Physics. Britain's Roger Penrose, professor at the University of Oxford, won half the prize of 10 million Swedish crowns for his proof that black holes are a direct consequence of Albert Einstein's general theory of relativity. Eddie Van Halen, one of rock music's greatest guitar players and a founding member of the top-selling band named after him and his brother, died of cancer on Tuesday. Van Halen's death was announced on Twitter by his 29-year-old son, Wolfgang, himself a bass player who joined the band in later years. Eddie Van Halen was known for his blinding speed control and innovative tapping technique, which propelled the band to be one of hard rock's most successful groups with hits like Jump, Panama, and Hot for Teacher. Eddie Van Halen was 65. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thanks so much for listening, and have a great day.